Today is the 19th of October, 1985, and this is a continuation of an interview of Fred Hemmings, Jr. Fred, I wonder if you could tell me about the role of the club in your life, including your position on the board of directors, which was what years?
I served two terms on the board of directors. I served in 71 and 72, then again in 74 and 75. And the club has, of course, been a prominent part of my social life and recreationally, but I think the most important thing the club has been for me is it's been the hub of my athletic life, my athletic career. I did play football at Punahou and was very fortunate to be one of the last Punahou teams to win the ILH football championship for Punahou back when we played in the old stadium. And of course, that's very fond memories, athletic memories for me. I'll never forget on Turkey Day, 1964, we ran in the Honolulu Stadium with 25,000 people, and then we played Kamehameha School for the ILH championship. And we beat Kamehameha 20-6. That was a very special experience and memory for me. As you know, Punahou had enjoyed a modest amount of success in the 20th century with football, maybe four or five ILH championships, and we happened to be one of them. Within the outrigger, though, the rest of my athletic career centered around the outrigger club. It has centered around, and I hope will continue to center around the outrigger club. I like to think of my athletic endeavors as actually double faceted. One is competitive athletics, which I think is separate from what I enjoy probably a little more, is the just plain recreational athletics, the running and paddling and surfing, and especially canoe surfing, just for my own pleasure. In the competitive side of athletics, I think the two major activities that I've enjoyed and enjoyed a certain amount of success in have been canoe paddling and surfing. I began canoe paddling in 1956 when I joined the outrigger at the old Outrigger Canoe Club, and we used to practice back then. There were no fiberglass canoes, and we practiced our canoe paddling in Kokina and the Leilani. And also, believe it or not, we trained, I'll never forget training in the Kamui, which is the big old surf canoe that we used to have. It probably weighed 800 pounds. And I learned how to steer back then, and I just was remembering, you know, when you go through life, you have your mind can bring up these little visions, and I'll never forget that I was 10 years old, and I was learning how to steer, and we went out past canoe surf, which I'd never been before, because I was restricted in where I could surf the canoes, and Queens and baby surf in front of the Royal, and we took this big canoe out and turned left and started heading towards Publix, and it was low tide. And you know, for a young kid, 10 years old, I look back on now how awesome I thought it was to be paddling a canoe out way out past the surf and down to Publix. And back then, George Downing was the coach of the outrigger, and we paddled the canoe right near the reef at Public Bass there, and I thought, my gosh, this, what an adventure this is, coming so perilously close to the reef and the canoe and being out at sea in the canoe. And
maybe you better explain Public Bass. They refer to it as Public Bass anymore. Yeah,
it is. It's important to know that all the surf sites have names, and the names are ancient Hawaiian names, or they might be contemporary names. And the name Public Bath is attributed to an area outside what we call now called the Queen Surf Area, where they used to have, in fact, public baths. So the publics could go down and go to the beach, and they could bathe in public showers and public baths, and the surf there became known as public baths.
You know, that's interesting, because I haven't heard that phrase for years, and I remember my mother would say, we're going to go to public baths, and of course it was just a phrase. I never even thought what the words meant, you know.
Yeah. I think for future generations, it maybe might not surf. Good surfers and good watermen aren't just people who excel in a physical ability. They are people who develop an awareness or sixth sense or true feeling for what their sport is. And I think in the case of especially canoe paddlers and surfers, the real good ones, the ones that endure and the ones that become the great leaders of the sport, develop a sixth sense and develop a kinship with the ocean. And I'll never forget, that's one of the great things I knew about the Duke. That Duke was really, Duke Hanamoku was really intimately involved and had a what I call a lifelong love affair with the ocean. And he knew the ocean. He could look at the ocean and he could see the currents and he could see the wind and he could look at the surface and the reef and he could see the fish, and he developed a degree of awareness and kinship with the sea that is partly what made him so great. And I think it's true of great surfers and canoe paddlers that they develop this very intimate relationship with the ocean. In the case of surfing, good surfers know their surfing spots, and if you you know, if you talk to a good surfer, he'll know every, especially an old-time surfer in Waikia, he'll know every surf spot from Diamond Head all the way down to past Kewalo Basin. And each little spot or each little break where you can ride a peak or a wave has a name. Public Bass, Castle Surf, which was, of course, the big surf that only breaks on the large south swell. In ancient Hawaii, it was called Kalehuawehi. We have a place called Old Man's. Now, Old Man's only became Old Man's when the outrigger moved up here, and a lot of the old guys would go out there and surf. So the kids said, well, then we're going to call that Old Man's. Up near a place up here at Kalaholi Beach near the foot of Diamond Head, the old Tong family had a home. And back when I was a kid, a lot of the Diamond Head kids would surf up there, and they'd go to the Tong's home. And so that surf became known as Tong's. And near Tong's, a barge went aground years ago, and there's a winch sticking up, and that little break is called winch. So if you go through Waikiki, every one of the little breaks have a name. Some of them are very ancient and old. Queen Surf is named Queen Surf because of Queen Kapi'olani. Canoe Surf has been called Canoe Surf, I think, for a very long time, because that's where the canoes can surf gently. So you can work your way through Waikiki, and each little break has a history and a name that's indicative of where it is. My surfing career began in Waikiki, but I think we started talking about canoe paddling. I started as 10 years old, and 56 of us had paddled in the age group summer regattas in 1965. Well, I have to mention that we had a group of kids that grew up together: Johnny Sutherland, Gary Blyke, Jeff Avery, Don McKay was on our crew off and on, Bill Jackson, Bruce Clifford, all my contemporaries. And we started at a very young age together, 13 and under, and we went up through boys 18 and under. And we really had one of those great group of guys that paddled together, and we were extremely successful. I mean, we won, I'll never forget, our last year together, some of us were going to college, so we kind of realized that our last year paddling together would be our year at 18 and under crew at the state championships in Hilo. We won the 18 and under boys race in a very fast time for the mile, and then our whole crew moved up to the junior men, and we got second in junior men. So we have very fond memories of paddling, and those group of guys, some of them are still very active in athletics. We kind of grew up with that paddling group when we did so. 1965, I first tried out when I was 19 years old. I tried out for the men's Molokai race as a steersman, and I was doing some traveling with Duke then, and I had to go away for 2 or 3 weeks and didn't make the team. But I did come across the channel for the first time in 65, and my brother was paddling on the crew, and the outrigger won the Molokai to Oahu canoe race. And the following year, you mentioned earlier about specific memories of athletic events. The following year was 1966, and it was probably the most epic of the Molokai to Oahu canoe races. First of all, you have to understand something about the Molokai to Oahu canoe race. It was founded in 1952 by club member Toots Minville, and Toots Minville was more or less a man of vision, and he really has done much to promulgate canoe paddling. He introduced it and made it popular in California. He helped introduce it in Australia. He even took a canoe to Europe several years ago. Duke is considered the patriarch of the Molokai canoe race, and he found that he's nourished it all these years. But the Molokai race has become...
Did you say Duke? Or
no, I mean Toots.
Right,
excuse me.
Right, uh-huh.
The Molokai race is the ultimate challenge in the sport, one, because of its tradition and its longevity, but secondly, it brings together a fascinating... fascinating elements, the element of team sport, which exists anywhere, but with paddling especially. The fact that there are changes, open ocean changes made, where you have six people in the canoe at any time, but you have nine members on the crew, so you constantly are rotating or making these open ocean changes. You have currents and tides, and you have wind, and so it becomes a race of many variables. And often, more often than not, the winner of the race is not only the team that can paddle a canoe fastest, but the team who's most capable of intelligently handling these variables and doing all these things right. And it's a very, very strategic race for that reason. What you do and how you maneuver in the course of the 5.5 to 6 hours it takes to complete the race becomes very important. And now it's become so sophisticated, as in the case of several weeks ago, the Molokai race is... won or lost by a minute or two, but between first and second. So it's a very intense sport. Nevertheless, in 66 was my most vivid memories of the race. I've been active in the race since 65, but believe it or not, I've only actually paddled or steered in 9 races. I've been fortunate enough to be in 4 winning boats, and I've been in 2 second place boats. And 66, though, we failed to finish the race.
What happened?
Looking back on it now, there may be a good chance that nowadays they wouldn't allow the race to go on because it was an epic day with a huge groundswell running across the channel combined with near gale force winds. I'd say the winds were 40 knots, maybe 50 knots at times, and it was a very, very perilous, dangerous situation. We started the race, and about mid-channel, I'd say, we were definitely in contention for the lead. It was so hard to tell back then, but north of us was Waikiki Surf Club, and I would say we were battling for first place mid-channel with Waikiki Surf Club. And prior to that point, one of the fellows in our crew who we did not know, but was, you know, when you paddle and train for the race, you're paddling in the lee of Oahu, and it's very calm water, but this one fellow is just basically scared of the ocean. And it came time for him to make a change, and in his haste to get out of the boat, he jumped out of the boat without adequately pulling his zipper down off his canvas around his waist, and that tore that canvas right there. And what happened was water was pouring into the boat when the big waves would break on it. So we were doing a lot of bailing and stuff. So this fellow got on the guide boat. He was told, look, you can't do that again. We're in terrible trouble now. We're taking water. Next time you make sure you unzip the boat again. The guy was basically not in complete control of himself, so they put him back in the boat, and after his second period of paddling, they told him it's time for change, and this time he took the zipper and ripped it right off the track. So then we had 2 of the 4 seats were not adequately covered by the canvas, and soon after, we just swamped mid-channel. And I'll never forget that, because it's one of those things where you slowly... you lose all your energy, you kind of go into like a daydream. You're so exhausted, and you go into kind of like a suspended animation. Everything was rather hazy, but we were in the middle of this channel and waves breaking all over the place, and finally we came to realize that there was no way we were going to continue the race after about an hour of trying to bail the boat and everything possible doing it. So we took a knife and we cut the rigging off the boat, and had a big escort boat called the Hula Kai that was escorting us across the channel, and then Tommy Arnott was driving a Boston Whaler. And we took the Ama and the Yakus and put it in the Hula Kai. We figured, well, the only way we're going to get our boat to Leilani back is by trying to get it in the back of the Hula Kai. So the Hula Kai tried to hold itself steady in the rolling seas, and we managed to swim the Leilani, turn it upside down and swim it like a log to the back of the Hula Kai. And at the right moment, the guys in the Hula Kai, when the water lifted the Leilani up to the back transom, they grabbed the nose of the Leilani and pulled the canoe slowly up into the back of the Hula Kai. And the boat had received, of course, tremendous damage. It was all torn up, and the bells were ripped off, and the munnows were broken and stuff. But we did get it back, and that's the story of the 66 race.
Well, what about a race that where you had great success? And is there a more exciting race?
That was a vivid memory. Yeah, but what's really funny is we came back in 67, and it was the glassiest race we're in. I mean,
this last race?
Oh, no, much more. There was not a swell. It was perfect glass in 1967. There was not a swell. It was like paddling, right outside canoe surf. There wasn't even a wind chop. It's one of those Akakona days when there was absolutely no wind, and there wasn't even a ripple on the surface. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget the challenge then was, of course, the heat. We got a very tremendous heat exhaustion. But we paddled in 67, and we won the race just straight on straight paddle.
Now, when you're paddling, are you thinking about anything? I mean, or is it just
canoe
almost
paddling
like
and this is what's great about sports, when you get to the highest level of competition, I feel that what really separates the true champions from the field is their abilities, their mental abilities, because I've oftentimes seen people overcome what would be considered physical handicaps by mental capabilities. In the Molokai race or in any canoe race, it's become such a sophisticated sport. You ultimately get your body to a certain amount of conditioning where you're not going to get in much better shape. You know, you're going to reach kind of a plateau mentally. So the really great paddlers and the great athletes in any field of endeavor are the ones that have developed a sixth sense for their sport and have honed their mental skills. And in paddling, as with many sports, concentration becomes a real big element. The finesse of your stroke and the ability to sustain your power to the water and being able to concentrate your energies. And you got to remember, when you're in a race, and nowadays, back in the 60s when we were racing, we were averaging 42 to 44 strokes a minute. We're using larger, big-bladed Hawaiian-style paddles. Nowadays, we're using narrow-blade paddles, and the stroke count's up to 65 or 70 strokes a minute. When you're paddling at that vigorous of a pace, you're doing 65 strokes a minute, and you're doing 3,600 strokes, an hour. So it becomes a pretty intense situation, and every stroke counts. So your ability to concentrate and really be keenly aware and understand what you're doing.
Is there a difference between running, playing football, surfing? Is it the same sort of mental discipline and physical issues?
Sure, I think in anything you do, mental discipline is a key element.
But are there differences between...
In the sports and the disciplines, the actual physical differences are profound. Sport is advancing so rapidly that we're finding things out about muscle structure and conditioning. And back in the 68 race, incidentally, 65, I was a helper, and my brother paddled on the team, and we won the race. 66, we went down. 67, we paddled in absolutely, the Molokai race, in absolutely glassy conditions, and we run the race. 68 was another storm year, and it was very rough, and we turned over mid-channel, got the boat righted, and came back and still won the race in 68. Mm. My other brother, Aka, was paddling with me then. All three of us, my brothers, have paddled and won that race.
Now, you were steersman of the nine races.
I've always steered and paddled.
Uh-huh.
In 67, I steered the whole way without stopping. In 68, I steered and paddled, alternating.
I see.
But in that particular race, it was very rough water, and we turned over and got the boat righted and continued on and won the race, which was exciting.
Well, that's a real accomplishment.
Yeah. And then in 69, I raced, and we got second, and then I've been involved in other activities, so I'd go off and on with paddling or helping or coaching. But the race is an epic athletic event, Hawaii, and I think you're going to see as years go on, this year's race, for instance, was highly publicized, and the international kayaking community is getting interested in it. I think the race will become a very big international event. It is considered the world championship of the sport of canoe paddling, and canoe paddling is growing rapidly. Australians are taking it up there, very competitive people. Of course, this year's winner of the canoe race, the Illinois Brigator, actually whitewater kayak marathon paddlers from the Midwest. So the sport's going to take off as a sport, and I'm quite proud of it. One of my themes is that Hawaii is the sports capital of the world, and this is just another event that I think proves it. So, but Outrigger can be very proud of its role in canoe paddling, because not only is it a leading source of championship teams and efforts, it also is a major contributor to the betterment of the sport. The Outrigger has and through the wisdom of its board of directors and through the assistance of its many athletes, has done much to help the sport. We host clubs, we lend our equipment out, we sponsor races, many of our members, I've worked with Walter Guild, and who was a little younger than me, and several other members. We've conducted clinics for other clubs, and so the Outrigger, I think, has been a real asset to the sport of Hawaiian canoe racing.
So now we have to get into the Olympics, right?
There's a good chance that the sport of canoe paddling will go to the Olympics. It's picked up by more nations. I'm sure it will. The surfing situation is a little different. I, of course, simultaneously with growing up at the Outrigger as a young boy, got my first surfboard. My surfing career culminated in 1968 with winning this World Surfing Championship. I had always,
That was where?
In Rincon, Puerto Rico.
Okay.
But really the most vivid and nicest memories I have of surfing go back to being a very young boy and surfing in the Makaha International Surfing Championships, which was produced and managed and directed by one of our sister canoe clubs, Waikiki Surf Club.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really something very special, because it was like a week or 2 weeks of every day something was happening during Christmas vacation. It was like a water sports carnival at the old Makaha contest.
Mm-hmm. What years are we talking about?
We're talking about 58, 59, mm-hmm. 60, in the early 60s. Makaha International Surfing Championships by Waikiki Surf Club was the premier international surfing event, and there was no other major surfing event in Hawaii. And they had body surfing, paddleboard races, tandem surfing, women's surfing, junior men's and senior men's competitions. And you'd go out every morning, and because people knew that the event was going to be out, there'd be 2,000-4,000 people on the beach out there, and they'd decide in the morning according to surf what they would hold. I competed first in 1958 as a 12-year-old in the junior men's and got third place, and ended up winning the old Makaha surfing contest as a junior twice and as a senior twice, and went on to compete and represent the Outrigger Canoe Club and Hawaii in the World Surfing Championships in 1968 in Puerto Rico. Once again, the Outrigger was...
Getting back to that World Championship, you know, what type of competition did you have, you know?
Very heavy competition. Yeah. In fact, I've always been a very conservative person. Even when I was a youngster, I was conservative. Who knows why that is?
I think that dad that made you paint your surfboard bright orange.
Yeah, or maybe my mother in the Catholic Church. Who knows? but the fact is, in the 60s, late 60s, the sport of surfing was going through some rough times. It was very chic, and back then there was LSD, and drugs were in vogue. And as with the youth all over the world, surfing got caught up in it. And back then, I don't know if you remember, but all the guys were wearing Nehru jackets and had beads on, and it was kind of like mysticism and LSD and marijuana and anti-American. It was all this. This whole mental aberration that the youth were going through, and surfing really got caught up in it. Well, I was just the opposite. I went to Puerto Rico, and because I didn't fit the mentality of the sport then, I was very much a rebel with my peers. I was short-haired and very conservative and very pro-American, and and anti-drugs, very anti-drugs. And as a result, I got to Puerto Rico representing Hawaii. And I'll never forget the Outrigger Canoe Club. I went there with their blessing, and they, in order to, they gave me a great blue blazer with an Outrigger emblem on it. And I was very proud of that. And I wore this blazer and a tie and everything to every official function. And I often make a joke about it. I felt like an IBM salesman at a Cheech and Chong convention, you know, amongst all these gurued out surfers. And not only that, but when you have a sport like surfing, back then it was kind of a mixture of sport, and a lot of the surfers back then thought they were artists. You know, it's this great spiritual experience that surfing was, which in some ways it is, but it certainly is a sport by every measure of the word. The mentality of the sport was in that area, which is, so I was actually a conservative rebel amongst these surfers, and I went out and I used tactics of just good aggressive athletic competition. I went there. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. I ran on the beach every morning. I paddled. I got myself in good physical shape. I wanted to win the event. Before I went into the finals, I looked at the judges. I thought to myself, well, now, what are these people? How do they surf? They're all surfers. What do they appreciate? I made a very explicit point of analyzing how they felt, and I went out and I won the event. And it just kind of set the surfing, because
very logical, analytical approach, you know, with a good body and a good mind.
Yeah, but the
makes sense.
But the it set the surfing world on its ear, because all the favored guru kind of in aid crowd, all the glamour boys of the sport had been beaten, and so it was kind of a interesting situation. But I'd always, and I came back to Hawaii, and at that time it was really. This sequence of events was really what led me to develop the business of promoting sports and surfing competition, because I thought the sport deserved better and deserved more of a professional image. And so I actually feel responsible in some ways of developing the professional sport. I created and produced the first major professional surfing competitions, and was able to negotiate contracts with both ABC and NBC to cover some of these competitions, and they're still in existence today, and on television. So it's interesting how all of things transpired, and the sport has matured considerably since then. And I'm very proud to say that most of the top surfers today, because of the development of professional surfing, are pretty responsible, well-trained, and well-motivated athletes. They're no longer this kind of cult. Surfing had a cultism in the 60s, and now they're much more athletic
Now the international competition?
The Macaha International, right.
No, in Peru. That.
Yeah, the Peru, no, that was I first went to, in the course of becoming the Macaha champion, I was invited to represent Hawaii in the Outrigger with our sister club in Peru, which we talked about last time, at Club Waikiki.
Was this before?
This was before Puerto Rico, right. Okay. So I competed several times, first in 1964. Okay. No, actually, it was 1964 in March of 64. I was a junior at Punahou School, and I got invited to represent Hawaii. I had won the Macaha Internationals in December of 63, and so March of 64, I went to Peru to represent the Outrigger in Hawaii in the Peruvian International.
And the Puerto Rico was in 19.
Yeah, the Puerto Rico World Championship was inaugurated. The World Championship competition was inaugurated in 65 in the major surfing nations of Australia, California, Hawaii, and went to this event. I didn't go in 65, it was held in Australia. Fellow member Joy Cabell went and did real well. In 66, the World Championship was held in Peru, and I attended that and got fifth. And that's when Outrigger, friend of the Outrigger, Felipe Pomar, won. And the Outrigger has a very close friendship, very close ties to Club Waikiki in Peru, and many of the Peruvians are good friends. Felipe Pomar became known as the Wild Bull of Punta Rocas, because Punta Rocas was the place where the event was held. In 67, they didn't hold it. In 68, the federation that was of international surfing organizations held the World Surfing Championship in Puerto Rico, a place called Rincon, which is at the west end of the island, near the Mayagüez Hilton. And it's very similar to Hawaii, cane fields and the more or less tropical balmy beach. And we went there, and the surf, as usual with a lot of surf contests, was not there for about a week. But finally, the last day of competition, I was in the, of course, the senior men's division. And I made it through the preliminary rounds, and we had the semifinals and the finals, and we held the semifinals at a place called Domes, and the surf was about 6 feet in the morning, and I made it to the finals, and they decided, because the surf had come up a little bit, and Domes was getting what you call closed-out surfing, the surf was about 8 feet, they moved it down the coast about a half mile to a mile to a place called Rincon. And
was that R-I-N-C-O?
Rincon, like corner, R-I-N-C-O-F, and Rincon. And I paddled out with the six other finalists, three Australians, Reno Abalero from Hawaii, and Mike Doyle from California. And I won the event and became the world champion.
The reason I mentioned, you know, the early event, which would have been in Peru,